even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport in association with Lacquer. Bicycle insurance powered by the community.
Welcome to the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport, the home of cycling, brought to you by Lacquer. I'm Graham Wilgos, and joining me, of course, Bradley Wiggins.
Hi.
welcome back, Brad. New sponsor.
Everyone's, another new sponsor, Shellac.
Everyone's
no, Lacquer. What is it called? Lacquer.
Everyone in cycling's doing it.
Yeah, everyone is doing it in cycling. Yeah. Lacquering.
And joining us this week, I'm very happy to say, a true classics specialist, Milan San Remo, Liège Bastogne Liège winner, Simon Gerrans. Simon, welcome.
Thank you, guys. Good to be here.
Good to have you. It's convenient for you to drop in, Simon, isn't it? Because you're a London man now.
He lives in Feltham.
As lovely as it is out here, I'm not that close to Feltham. No, in Clapham, so central London, just down the road. So, yeah, quite convenient to drop in.
So you've retired from the pro peloton, but you've taken up a sporting internship with Goldman Sachs. You're a city man now.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, big change from obviously racing in the pro peloton, but...
Now you're racing in Richmond Park.
I stepped into another very competitive environment. That's in finance. So, yeah, big change, but it's going well so far.
First question I need to ask you actually on that is there more psychopaths, or are there more psychopaths in the city or in the peloton?
Well, there's a lot of psychopaths in the peloton, that's for sure. I'm only new to this city, so I'm not going to say I haven't come across any as yet, but I definitely know a lot more psychopaths in the peloton.
Who's the biggest psychopath in the peloton?
Oh, who's the biggest psychopath?
Real one, like clinical or...
Well, either.
Because there's quite a difference between a clinical psychopath than the kind of everyday branded around term of, oh, he's a psycho.
You sound like Steve Peters coming out.
No, because I've lived with psychopaths, so I know the difference between a clinical one and an actual, you know what I mean? We're not going to go into that because this isn't the forum for... No, but... Yeah, go for it. Knock yourself out. Go.
Quite a psychopath in the peloton. I've dropped myself in it now. I could have sent any odd name in the city, and you wouldn't know who I was talking about. I guess there's quite a few guys that you'd say they're on the spectrum.
Yeah, there has to be by nature of the fact that I won't get myself into too much trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, maybe we should move it on. Simon, London roads. You've been out on your bike a little bit, not half as much as you were in your career. But how have you found London roads so far?
Well, needless to say, I didn't move here to ride my bike. That's for sure. And it's probably not the most ideal cycling destination. But I get out my bike once a week, generally on just one morning on the weekend, and head out towards Surrey, sort of out that way around the hills.
Did you ride the Olympics in London?
I did. Yeah. So, and that was until I was here late last year. The last time I was actually on these roads were for the Olympics. And it's nice out there. You get out early in the morning, sort of beat the traffic and whatnot, and there's a ton of bike riders out as well. So I'm not finding it too bad.
You get recognised much?
Oh, every now and then, probably more when we stop at the cafe. Generally stop at one of the cycling cafes somewhere. And, yeah, because they're accommodating to park the bikes out the front and whatnot, and you sort of get recognised there. But otherwise, I'm pretty well... run under the radar.
Do you still have the nicest bike?
Probably not. You know what? I was able to hang on to my training bike from last year. Mm. So just riding my old BMC training bike at the moment. But yeah, there's plenty of guys that tip quite a few bucks into their bikes, that's for sure. So there's some very nice bikes around.
Anyone ever try and race you?
Not so much these days, no. And probably now that I'm not riding around in team kit, yeah, I'm not getting raced as much.
Brad, every time you're on the bike now, is that the case?
Someone very tries rare to race these you?
Well, what about your little boy?
Yeah, I don't really. He goes out on his own, really. I've sort of not got involved with my son racing, but he, where he lives, quite quiet. You know, you don't bump into too many cyclists. I think it's worse in London. You go out on a weekend in London, it's just heaving. So I don't really have that bother anymore. Not that I'm up for the challenge either. So,
so don't try.
Those days are over.
Your hour record's there.
Go for it. Knock yourself out.
If everyone wants to have a crack at that.
Don't cheat. Don't go to altitude. Do it at sea level. Unless you want to Campenaerts. Go on, mate, have a good go.
We'll be talking more and hopefully hearing from Victor Campenaerts.
Let's call him Walter then.
I called him Victor.
Did I call him Walter though?
I don't know why.
What is his real name?
Victor Campenaerts.
Victor, right. Sorry, I might be following a different blog.
We might have someone different on the show. Who knows?
Don't know.
Simon, you have, of course, stepped away from the pro peloton altogether. One man who announced this week that he's taking an indefinite break from cycling is Pete Kenyuk. He's a former Sky man. Both of you rode with him at Team Sky, of course. Tell us a little bit about him.
I mean, I watched Pete grow up through the academy system at BC, and he was immensely talented, junior world champion on the track as a kid. Seemed to have everything in front of him. You know, obviously, we're talking about his retirement quite early, really. Obviously, it's early in the season, but also early for... I mean, you still consider him like an age. I look at him like he's like quite a youthful 21-year-old, but I think he's near 30
now,
isn't he?
He's 29. 29.
So he's still quite... You're relatively young to be retiring, but I think, you know, he's got certainly got a couple of kids. But he's had actually quite a good little career, even though he hasn't maybe fulfilled the massive potential of Team Pursuit Olympic champion, stage win in the Dauphiné, leader's jersey in the Vuelta. So he's had a good run at things.
Twice national
race
champion.
I think there are other things at play here that have forced his decision, really, which I think have been well documented and well reported. But, you know, having said that, you know, you have to wish him all the best, really, and actually praise him on the career he has had. You know, he's retiring with some palmares, even though we may sit here thinking it's quite early and he hasn't fulfilled his potential. But he's a great young lad, and I'm sure whatever he does now, he'll be successful at.
Simon, what's your experience of riding with Pete Kenyon?
Yes, I remember Pete because I think he was a Neo Pro when they launched Sky in 2010. So obviously Bradley and I were both on the team there with him. And he was just like this enthusiastic young kid in that, like a kid in a candy store, basically. You could just see him soaking it all up. And I raced with him quite a bit throughout sort of 2010 and I think 2011 as well. And I remember him just being a fantastic young guy. And obviously the years following that, we crossed paths at many races and yeah, it was the kind of guy I always said hello to and always checked in with. But I guess when you get to a scenario like this, when he's sort of called the end to his career and I'd say still in his 20s, sort of quite prematurely by traditional standards, you just hope that everything's good with him and all's well for him as a person rather than sort of the loss to the sport. You think, okay, as long as he and himself is doing all right.
Obviously, as there is in any sport, an awful lot of pressure that we don't necessarily see, particularly as, you know, as fans watching on TV, which we all are now. Is there a sort of a particular pressure point that you might feel going from, particularly from going from Team Sky, where he was maybe comfortable, to going to Bora Hansgrohe, as he has been in the last
It might
last
be.
Few
I mean,
seasons?
He grew up with the likes of Rod Ellingworth and all that, you know, so I think it was a system that he was very used to. He'd come through, they nurtured him through that BC system and straight into Sky, so he'd never known anything else, really. Mm. So it must have been quite a change, really, from being a 15, 16-year-old kid at British Cycling going into what is the German team. You know, I think that must have been quite hard for him. Because there would have been a level of expectation on him, you know, having took him from Team Sky, where you kind of like, okay, do for us what you did at Team Sky. Whereas at Team Sky, they kind of knew him inside out, and I think he was in Chris's 2013 tour winning team, and was quite an integral part to that. He was one of the strongest riders in that tour for Chris, one of the support riders along with Richie. So you know, he has had moments of brilliance over the years riding for Sky, but. You know, I think his family are far more important to him and his children than this life of professional racing. I think sometimes that line can get a bit skewed, and when you're in it, you can think that this is the be-all and end-all, and it's do or die, and it feels like life and death sometimes when you're in it. The minute you can draw yourself out of it and get a bit of perspective, you realise that there's much more out there to do, and he's took that decision, and you know, good on him for having the balls to do it this early in the season and be so public with why he's done it as well.
It's an indefinite break, we should say, as well, rather than a full stop in terms of his retirement. But as we all say, we wish him well. It's a huge period in cycling then. Races coming thick and fast. Tour of Flanders today, chaps. Thrills and spills everywhere. 6 hours and 20 minutes in the saddle. Can be 270 kilometres of sheer hell. Brad, you said you used to quite enjoy it as a rider, though.
Yeah, I mean, there's no hiding in Flanders. It is, you can guarantee, if you win the Tour of Flanders, you were the strongest rider on the day. And I think, you know, Alberto proved that today. You know, he was by far and away the strongest rider in the last 20K. When you consider the amount of strong hitters that were in that second group, you know, he was the man. And, I mean, special mention probably to Matthew van der Poel, really, who I think everyone was surprised just to see him back in that group, considering what had happened to him early in the day. But it's a brilliant race. It's a great race to watch. I think part of me prefers the old format. We used to do the Muir and the Bosberg and then the final run-in. But it's still a great race. And you see, you know, the weather like it is today and just the crowds that turn out for the race. This is my favourite period of the year now, you know, Flanders. And then obviously we've got a week to wait now till Roubaix.
Alberto Bettiol then, as you said, Education First, went off the front with about 15 kilometres to go and held the gap. Simon, you were particularly impressed with him, weren't you?
Yeah, very much so. So Bettiol and I were teammates last year and actually roomed with him quite a bit. And he had such a troublesome season last year. He was seriously underdone at the beginning of the year. You see, he hadn't put a lot of effort into his pre-season. So he was carrying it a bit of weight throughout the year. He had several really untimely crashes. I think he broke his collarbone two or three times. So just a year with constant interruption. So to see him start out this season with such consistent performances. And then obviously to get the first win of his professional career at the Tour of Flanders, yeah, I'm seriously impressed.
Pink helmet, of course.
Rider ever to win the Tour of Flanders in a pink helmet.
Yes. You said when
cycling really has changed.
You said when we were watching, a man in a pink helmet can't be winning it. But
a pink helmet and them stupid glasses they wear. But hey, they are sponsored by him, and we have to respect that.
Kasper Askren then to Koenig Quickstep in second place, and Alexander Kristoff completing the podium.
And Van der Poel fourth, wasn't he? So
he was, yeah. We're particularly impressed with him this week too, and he went down today. So, I mean, you seem to think that he deserved it when he went over his handlebars. The impact wasn't too harsh on him, so he was able to get up, carry on, chase back on, and then he was there in the final, in the mix-up.
Yeah, honestly, when I saw him go down there, I thought we're not going to see him back at the front of the race again, particularly for the efforts he had to make to rejoin the front group. But I don't know whether he thought he was still on his cross bike or what there. He jumped over a nature strip, obviously double punched, and so paid the price for that. Yeah. And then, his front wheel warped so quickly it threw him straight over the handlebars. And the way he was sitting on the pavement there holding his shoulder, it looked like he might have done his collarbone.
Yeah.
So to see him just a few minutes later back up and chasing, he obviously finished on his spare bike and joined back to the group of favourites, was a very, very impressive ride.
Well, as you mentioned there, he's cleaned up at cyclocross before coming to the pro peloton. Yeah, as we say, not only did he get up and carry on, he was then attacking with Bob Jungels and then in the mix-up for the final.
Yeah, he's a class act. I mean, he's the future. He'll win this race one day like his father. He's overperforming for his age, and I think, you know, he's only been doing the road for his first proper season on the road now. I know he was doing a bit last year, but considering he'd been come straight off of a cross season, and you know, we'll be talking about him in 10 years' time as winning this race. Eighth place, big Alejandro Valverde.
Yeah, obviously. 47
years of age.
He was up there in the top 10.
Quite something for a 47-year-old to be up there at this stage of the game. But, I mean, that just shows, you know, we every year he just never ceases to amaze me. You know, just he just seems to get better every year. Or he's certainly plateaued a bit now, which is quite good.
Yes.
Top 10 in the Tour of Flanders as world champion, you know, and you can imagine him lining up at the Tour and the Vuelta. We'll still be talking about him at the end of the season at the Worlds. He's just incredible. His constitution to race is quite amazing.
Yeah, it's a bounce back every time. Mm. Who else were we impressed with today? So in that final shake-up, we had Sagan, Ollie Nason, Van der Poel, Bob Jungels, Wout van Aert, Michael Matthews, your countryman, Simon, was hanging on at the back there as well.
Yeah, considering the sort of limited racing Matthews has done this year, he's obviously just sharpened up enough to be racing at the front. He won a couple of stages in Catalunya last week, so I think this is probably his first real crack at Tour of Flanders. To see him finish in the front group is a strong ride. But I just thought it was an exciting race. Right down to the wire, we didn't know who was going to win. And for the past few years, we've seen Tour of Flanders wrapped up fairly early with a strong break that was never going to come back. So I thought it was a really good addition.
What are your memories of the race? Because you were saying, Simon, you rode it as a Neo Pro.
Yeah, so I lined up in my first year pro with AG2R. And that year, they were just throwing me into every race to see what I could actually do and what I couldn't. And then from pretty much every season after that, I did the Tour of Basque Country, which starts the very next day after Tour of Flanders. So, I didn't do it for the rest of my career, basically. It was only in 2014 that Matt White had this harebrained scheme of he was going to send me to Flanders and try and win there. I went up and did a recon early season. It was about 2 degrees and raining sideways. And I said, screw this for kicks. There's no way I'm going to come and race this. So I went back to what I knew and did the Basque Country and the typical Ardennes.
Very sensible. Brad, what are your memories of it? Your face is still on the road, of course.
It is now, yeah. God knows why.
How long did that take you?
No, my crack team of Belgium, they're going out in an A-team van in the night and sorted that out. But I had I rode in 2002, and obviously it was my first edition. I rode. We had some riders in the team like Jackie Durand, who'd won the race, Frédéric Guédon, Paris-Roubaix winner, Baden Cook, and I just ended up, I remember riding in awe of most of, you know, these people I'd watched racing on TV, Museo, Ballerini, Van Petegem, Robbie McEwen, you know, all these kind of hitters really, André Schmil, and just kind of not wanting to get in their way. You know, every time we approached a climb, you know, it's kind of like, oh God, Museo's here, oh, this Schmil, I better get out of the way. You know, didn't feel worthy to be in their company really, and you just didn't want to disrupt their race or anything, but try and do your job for your team at the same time. And then obviously I rode it towards the end of my career as well, and in the current format, finishing in Udenada, and it was just an amazing race really. And at that time we were working for Geraint Thomas, who was still, you know, pursuing the classics career, never thinking he'd go on to win the Tour, you know, a few years later. So it's really become an all-rounders race now with the current format, hence why the likes of Valverde and those guys get up there. So it's just a great day out, and it's a great thing to be part of. If you can come through the kind of mess and the melee and the crashes and end up in that final, it's an amazing thing to be part of.
In the women's race, which we, of course, need to mention, Marta Bastianelli, Team Virtus Cycling, won in a three-rider sprint, beating Annemiek van Vleuten, Michelin Scott, and Cecile Utrup-Ludwig to the line.
In 2019, cycling fans across Europe will be able to watch over 30 UCI World Tour events live on Eurosport and Eurosport Player, available on the app and online via eurosport.co.uk. Eurosport Player also allows viewers to catch up and relive all the action on demand. Eurosport will bring fans unrivaled expertise and analysis from all the best moments of the 2019 season.
Welcome back to the Bradley Wiggin Show by Eurosport in association with Lacquer. Chaps, I set you both a little bit of homework this week. I wanted to talk about your ultimate rider. So just to give this a little bit of context, if you were the DS and you could pick in your team your best GC man, yeah, your best time trialist, your best sprinter, climber, and possibly domestique,
right,
who would you pick each time? Let's start with the GC man.
Eddie Merckx, GC leader.
Easy
for
one.
Me. Yeah, has to be for me.
Simon?
Yeah. Well, I'm only going to look back over sort of throughout my career and maybe just a couple of years leading into that, because I was kind of starved of cycling. I was a late starter in the sport, and then, you know, it was very difficult to follow the sport from Australia. It was, you got, you know, a highlights package of a couple of stages of the Tour de France, where we were really exposed to in Australia. So it was only once I moved to Europe in sort of, you know, my late teens, nearly 20, that I really started to follow the sport and sort of started to admire the pros. So looking back over my career as a GC rider, there are a couple of real standouts, and I guess Contador was always very, very impressive as a GC rider. But I think if you look at the Tour de France in its format these days, you've got to be so complete, so you can't have any faults. It can't be just an outstanding sprinter or an outstanding time trialist. You've got to be a real all-rounder. And for me, the best all-round GC rider that I witnessed throughout my career was Lance.
What about the guys you've ridden
with? Well, be careful saying that on this show.
Do you disagree?
No. Hey, I've made my comments clear about him over the years, actually. I was going to ask you a question. Who's the one that kind of destroyed your expectations of what you thought they were? I mean, who was the loosest GC rider or GC leader that you raced with that you thought, God, how's this guy got top 10 in the Tour de France or something? Because I remember one guy that, as well, I'm asking, it's a bit loaded because I raced with him as well, and I used to think he was absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
In your AG2R days, so it's a bit of a loaded question.
Actually, it probably comes back to that a bit on the spectrum of being a bit psychotic, and Christophe Moreau.
He's
a great guy.
He's a lovely man.
A super generous leader. Like, I remember you get to a Tour de France party at the end of the tour, and he would stand in front of the bar, and he wouldn't let anybody buy a drink. He had to pay everyone's drinks all night. So he really looked after people in his team. And I remember a standout thing about Moreau, he would always thank his teammates at the end of the day. And you'd say, Christophe, maybe I might have only was able to bring him one bidden throughout the whole day. He's like, yeah, but that bidden, when it came, I really needed it, so thank you. So I remember that about
it's important. Murray. It's important as a young rider as well, that sort of stuff, right?
I remember that for my entire career.
But you're going to go out and kill yourself all over for him the next day too.
Absolutely.
What about, Brad, the people that you rode with or against, if you had to pick one for the GC leader, man, yeah.
I used to love riding with Christian Vandervelde. He was, he'd had a lot of experience riding with Lance and that, obviously, and he'd stepped out of the shadows as a kind of helper and tried to forge his own way. He kind of made that breakthrough in the 2008 Tour de France when he got fifth or fourth, I forget which one he was. But he was a lovely guy, very similar, you know, really thankful at the end of the day. And when I made my breakthrough in 2009, he was so supportive towards me, even though he was still our team leader. You know, when he knew that it wasn't happening for himself, he was very quick to sacrifice his own race for me. So, again, you never forget those gestures from people. And Christian Vandervelde was always someone that really impressed me as a leader, the way he went about his business.
What about sprinters then? I think one man obviously stands out, especially if we're talking Tour de France. But
Abdul Japarov, is that?
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's Cav. It has to be Cav.
The Tashkent Express.
Yeah, I have to. We've got a pre-nut, me and Cav. Well, we're always nice to each other now. No, I have to go with Cav, yeah. I mean, his record speaks for itself. 30 stage wins in the Tour alone, forgetting the Giro and everything else. And at one time, probably when I was riding those years with him, certainly as world champion, when he was world champion at Sky, particularly the Champs-Élysées, he was the fastest man in the world. There's not many people, when you do a lead out, that you know 9 times out of 10 that he's going to win at the end of it. And it was much like that when he won the world title, which is why we pretty much rode for 200K. He only just won it at the end, but it's very, very rarely you ride for someone where, you know, you bet a lot of money, or you're certainly a house at the end, that they'll probably win if they get it right.
2014 tour on Mark Cavendish, Simon. That first stage into Harrogate, coming to the line.
The one you knocked him off.
I knocked him off. Yeah, I shouldered his head, wasn't it?
What are your memories of that? What did you say to each other after you picked each other up?
Didn't hurt yourself, did you? Did you break anything?
Yeah, though? Just some ribs. Yeah.
Oh, so you retired there as well, did you?
No, I kept going. I kept going. We were sort of on a bit of a bare bones Tour de France team, and I was sort of still with broken ribs. I was kind of the best shot of a result. So I was sort of shouldering a fair bit of responsibility going to that tour. But that sort of crash sort of ruined my tour from then on. Like, I persisted until stage like 17 or something, and then I thought, I'm not going to get anything else out of suffering through this tour. So I went home then. But yeah, as far as sprinters go, I would agree. You know, unless you're saying the green jersey is the mark for the best sprinter, and then, you know,
the intermediate
career,
sprints.
Yeah, I mean, Cuban was good in his day, wasn't he? He was on a part at one time when I rode my first tours in 2006, and that he was pretty much untouchable as well, Robbie, in those days.
And what was impressive about Robbie? He could find his own way. He didn't need a lead out,
and he could climb as
well.
Very good.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I'd seen him finish fourth in a race at the time, Tour of Mediterranean, which to finish at Montferrand, and he finished fourth at Montferrand.
Yeah,
one
right.
Day. They were very impressive, yeah.
Yeah. So as far as green jersey winners, you can't go past sort of Sagan these days.
Yeah, I think we have to mention him, don't we?
And throughout my career. But quick guys, Cav, his record speaks for itself.
We've been talking about Tour de France stages again. Merckx 34, Eno just behind Cav. Cav on 30. If you were to take away time trials from their respective palmares, then Merckx would be on 17 Tour de France stages. Eno would only be on 7, but Cav, obviously.
I know, it's all if, though, isn't it?
If some buts.
What I mean? It is what it is at the end of the day. It's a different era, it's a different time. So, you know, you could almost say in some ways that the sprints now are more hectic, the stages are faster than back in the day when maybe Merckx was winning bunch sprints and beating the likes of Freddie Mines and things. So it is what it is. I mean, it's, you know, very difficult to compare eras because the sport has changed so much.
Mentioned a sprinter who could climb then. What about pure climbers?
Well, there's so many that you could choose from, really. And climbers have now become kind of real hybrid athletes, you know, like the likes of Valverde finishing eighth in Flanders. And yet we'll see him maybe on the podium at the Vuelta at the end of the season. But Pantani, I raced with Pantani. I saw his natural talent on climbs and things. But it's a real tough one there. Yeah, I could say Pantani. But I'll probably pick someone from who I raced with who really used to impress me on the climbs, who made it look so easy, was Andy Schleck. In his prime, Andy Schleck, 2010, 2011, when he won Liège in 2009. And when he was that good, he made it look easy. And that was always a mark of how great a climber was, I always thought.
Simon, what you got for us?
Yeah, I was kind of thinking back and I was really never in the front enough in the big races to witness the best climbers doing their thing. So it was only from watching the replays on TV. But a guy like Heras, remember Roberto Heras, a little Spanish guy?
Yeah.
I think did he win a Vuelta? You know, I think he was recruited across by Lance to help him in the mountains.
Yeah.
And I remember just these little guys, and they just dance up the climbs and make it look so easy.
I want to talk about the help as well, your domestiques. Brad, let's start with you on this one.
Sean Yates, easy one for me.
Yeah.
Best domestic that ever lived.
Why say?
Just because he was just the respect that people hold him in, the admiration for what he did.
Yeah.
It was always about everyone else. He looked cool doing it, short shorts, big earring, no helmet.
Long hair.
Yeah, you know, and he was my hero when I was growing up, you know.
Yeah.
As a British rider, it was only him and Chris Boardman. Chris was always talking about heart rates and blood tests. Yates was talking about, it's not over till the fat lady sings. That was the difference between the two.
Proper polar opposite.
Yeah.
Simon?
I think Mick Rogers. And he was in your team for the Tour.
Yeah,
and,
but the thing with Mick is Mick at times was good enough to win the Tour. I still think what might have happened had he not crashed out in 2007.
Yeah.
On the run into Teen that year.
Exactly.
When he broke his collarbone, didn't he? I mean, he may have been the first Australian Tour winner that year.
Yeah.
Before Cadell, you know, and Mick then obviously spent the rest of his career riding in you know, he had his probably his best years in the last few years of his career, didn't he, when he won his Tour stage, his Giro stage.
Yeah. But he was riding for you in that year's Tour de France as a domestique, and he was a guy that was a great team's time trialist. He could ride the flats, he could ride the mountains. He had a cool head on his shoulders, so he could call the shots. When he focused on being a domestique, he looked like he was one of the best best I'd seen.
Definitely.
As team leader, were you ever marking everyone out of the game at the bar, insisting that only you buy the drinks.
We weren't allowed to drink, really, by the time I'd got to that stage. The game had changed so much. Like, when we won the tour, we didn't drink that night. We flew straight home because we had the Olympics five days later. I crashed out in 2011 of the tour, so went home. 2010, we had a little celebration at the end, but it kind of, I don't know, really. I never rode another tour again after that. But the drinking culture thing kind of went out of it by the time we got to Sky, really, because the game had moved on so much. I guess Paris is still a bit of a tear up for most people when you get to Paris. But yeah, the Sky years, it became much more businesslike, much more about getting the job done and get drinking when you get home because of what you were representing as well in terms of the brand. They didn't want people strolling down the Champs-Élysées at 3 a.m, you know, being sick and so.
What have you? You mentioned Sean Yates there. If we were to pick a rider purely on style, and you can't now pick Yates again, who else?
Maurizio Fondries for me, again. Most stylish man that ever lived.
Why say?
Just on the bike. He looks so aesthetically made, like he was born on a bike, you know? Yeah. Just beautiful to watch, yeah. And probably followed closely second by Francesco Moser.
Why so with Moser?
Again, another one, really. If you watched him on Cobblestones, and there's left a few scenes in Sunday in Hell, the famous film from 76, Roubaix, where it's just the top half of his body in the Italian Championships, and his back's, you could have a tea party on his back, it's that flat. But he's on cobbles, but you don't get the sense he's riding on cobbles because it looks like he's riding on a flat road, whereas most people riding on cobbles will be shaking up and down and making it look like they're, you know.
He's got his own built-in suspension.
Just, you know, always a mark of just someone aesthetically looks good on a bike. I've always been in love with the romance of that.
Simon?
For me, Michele Bartoli. So there's a pretty common theme with the Italians. Bartoli.
Pozzato was of our generation, was also class on a bike, you know.
I thought one of you might have said Cippo too.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
The old skin seat.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. Stephen Roach was beautiful to watch as well.
One more for you. If we're talking about your dream team rider in terms of pure psyche, who are we picking? Whose attitude was going to win you a race or win you a tour?
Well, I'd probably nick Mick Rogers now, you've mentioned it, actually, because he was like that. The other one, from a classics point of view, was Matthew Heyman. Would always get the best out of the people around him. Whatever his form was, he never really wondered too much about his form. It was always about how the team functioned and that. And he was... He wouldn't suffer falls either, you know. He'd be happy to tell someone what he thought if they weren't pulling their weight, and he was actually a dream to ride with.
Simon?
For me, probably O'Grady. O'Grady was really good at, you know, bringing everybody
there's
after.
Theme here.
You're just picking your mates.
Yeah, basically.
Which is fair.
As far as guys that I raced alongside and that were really good sort of culturally for the team to bring it the best out of everybody, Stewie would definitely bring the best out of everybody. You know, in the teams, he was super motivating, and he was a guy that I really liked to have alongside me when I was targeting a race. But he would also bring the best out of everyone in the bar afterwards as well. Like, it was all work or all play.
He wouldn't let you go to bed, would he? He'd be stood at the door stopping people leaving the bar.
Yeah.
You know, one of them.
All right. Well, we want your ultimate rider suggestions to please send them in.
Wait till the Eurosport works do at the end of the year.
Please send in your ultimate rider suggestions to us on Twitter at Eurosport_UK, and we'll read some of the best ones out on next week's show.
Listeners, it's time to tell you a bit more about our sponsor, Lacquer. Lacquer is a smarter way of insuring your bike and your gear. It's a community of cyclists joining together to save each other money. Lacquer covers all the basics like theft and accidental loss and damage, both at home and abroad. It'll also cover you in sportives and competition races, so long as you're not riding in the pro peloton. How does Lacquer work, you ask? Well, instead of charging you a fixed premium, with Lacquer you only pay a small share of the community's claims cost, and your share is proportionate to how much you insure. Lacquer locks in a maximum price cap to make sure there are no nasty surprises, even in months with lots of claims amongst the community. And when there are no claims that month, you could even pay nothing at all. Rest assured, claims are accepted fast, usually within 24 hours. On average, Lacquer's members have saved 61% on bike insurance. So why don't you investigate the benefits for yourself? Find out more at lacquer.co.uk and enter the promo code Wiggins to get £10 off. That's laka.co.uk and the promo code WIGGINS.
Simon, you've ridden with two brothers who seem to be adding more to their game every season, the Yates brothers at Mitchelton Scott. Tell us a little bit about riding with them.
Well, yeah, they're two brothers, obviously identical twins and with very similar sort of goals. But as riders, I see them as very different as far as their attributes go. Adam Yates is sort of very flamboyant. He'll attack on feeling. We've seen him win Classic San Sebastian. So he's a very sort of exciting rider to watch in that way. And I think Simon Yates, he's probably the one with more Grand Tour potential because he's way more calculated. Mm. He time trials very well. You can see his efforts are really well timed. And I think as far as a three-week race goes, he's probably the one with more potential.
You were saying last week, Brad, that Simon Yates is probably exactly where he wants to be at this stage of the season right now.
Yeah, he's won that time trial in Paris-Nice, which I know they wanted to really improve on going into the Giro. He's not too far off the pace, but he's not too high up the classement where you think maybe he's hit it too early. Catalunya was the one for me where he really, he was just there in that kind of 10 to 15, and Catalunya's a tough race. Mm. And we saw him on the last stage off the front with his brother and trying to help Adam get up there. So I think, he's just in the position where he can go either way now. He can fine-tune what he needs. He's not trying to hold form now at this stage. So we're just nearly a month away now from the start of the Giro. So it's looking perfect for him.
We think he's going to win it this time? Going to go that extra?
I think he will, because we haven't really seen Tom yet at this stage. Are we, Dumoulin?
Well, he's up there at UAE.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can't tell too much from that.
No, and Tom's someone who will ride himself in the Giro. Mm. I think I spoke to Matt White a bit this winter and what the things they were trying to improve on with Simon. And I think they learnt a lot from that Giro last year. And I think that showed at the Vuelta, particularly how the team rode at the Vuelta last year. Yeah. They learnt a hell of a lot in terms of losing that jersey and letting it go and bringing it back again. Mm. Obviously, it depended on form. As you know, the Giro is a tough race, but I think they'll get it right this year.
Well, it's kind of an all-star lineup at the Giro this year. He's got some pretty stiff competition.
Almost more exciting than the Tour.
Yeah, you look at the guys that are targeting the Giro, and he's going to have his work cut out for him to win this year's Giro. But he's definitely, everything seems like he's really on track. But I think coming back to what he learned against the Vuelta last year, it was probably having someone with a cool head like Julian Dean in the car. Because Julian Dean was the guy that was calling the shots in the Vuelta last year. And he was just making sure the guys conserved energy for as long as possible in that race, knowing it's a late season race. You don't have as many bullets to fire by that point in the season. So you have to really approach it conservatively. And I think he timed the effort for the team he had there really well.
What's he like as a leader? Is he quite communicative with the other riders? And does he talk a lot?
He doesn't talk a great deal, but he was always a guy that was really receptive to feedback. If you said to him basically, oh, let's ride position here, or tomorrow let's try and do this a little bit differently because we nearly got caught out or whatever, and he was very receptive for that and also very thankful.
On Grand Tours then, I wanted to ask you both, what are your memories of riding the Tour de France together? Brad?
Well, I think we both crashed in the two tours we rode together.
Yeah, you were, one of you went one year and the other went the next.
Yeah. Simon, you broke your elbow, did you?
Yeah, I broke my elbow on, I think it was stage 10 in the first tour that we raced alongside each other.
And then the second one, I broke my collarbone on stage 6, I think it was.
What's it like riding for Brad?
Oh, well, I enjoyed riding for Brad. We raced the Dauphiné together leading into the 2011 tour. So we did Paris-Nice, I think, in that year as well. Were you third?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. So we did a few races kind of alongside each other. And yeah, I think we raced pretty well together when we went.
Do you remember the first time you raced for me? I remember the first time I ever raced for you.
Oh yeah, when was that?
The 2002 Sun Tour.
I do remember that, when Cookie won.
Yes. Yeah, we were riding for a composite Francis Dujour team with Renshaw as a stagiaire.
Yeah.
And I think you were riding for VIS or something.
A mixed team of sorts. Yeah, I was still trying to turn professional. Yeah, I do remember that.
Happy days.
Simon, normally we do a question for Brad. You've got one for us, haven't you? Or you've got one for Brad, I should say.
Yeah, I've got a question for Brad. And I guess coming to this stage in my life, basically, it's not sort of in my career anymore because we're both retired, but I'm freshly retired and you're a couple of years ahead of me there, Brad. So I guess I'm always interested to any advice that you may have for me going to this next phase of my life post-racing.
We'll take up another Olympic sport. That might be a good way to start. be completely deluded and deny the fact that you've retired, I think actually you're quite unique. There's not many riders that do what you've done, really, in taking up a whole new industry and a whole new challenge, considering what you've achieved in the sport as well. I mean, it's quite admirable, really, considering how far away you live as well, your natural home, to come and bring your family, your wife and children into London and venture out because of your achievements, the way you speak and the way you hold yourself. You could have, easily walked into a punditry job, coaching, anything like that. So that's quite admirable, really, to do what you've done. And I think, you're already there, really. You're on the payroll there, aren't you? You're doing it now. You're learning a new... You're 3 or 4 months into the job now?
Yeah, a bit over 3 months in now.
So it's, you could have easily walked into a DS job, couldn't you, at Green Edge?
Yeah, but I was looking for a new job.
You're not that sad, are you? You're going to do something different.
I wanted to do something a bit different. Wanted to learn a new skill set. And I think, like I've heard you talk about, you kind of, for a little while after you stop, you kind of fall out of love with the sport for a little while. So I was kind of, to a certain extent, really falling out of love with cycling my last year or so racing. So I'm like, okay, what can I do that's different? What can I do that's a new challenge? And I've still maintained to ride my bike. I still watch the racing. So I never lost my passion completely. But yeah, I was up for doing something different.
We were talking about things last week with Matt, actually, that I find I'm still institutionalized in doing. Like from the French teams, I still take the middle out of the baguette or bread. Any bread at a dinner table, I take the middle out. Have you found anything hard to let go of? Like, do you still find yourself thinking, I'm putting weight on, even though you ride for most of your career underweight as a normal person? You know, all those little things that you kind of become institutionalized in doing. Have you found anything difficult to let go of?
Well, one thing that I find, it's a little bit institutionalized. So at work these days, they have casual Fridays. So you basically can choose what you wear into work. And I hate casual Fridays.
Like a nufty day at school, mufty day.
Because every other day of the week, it's a suit.
Do you have to pay a pound when you go in?
No, it's a suit. And it's like a uniform. It's like every day for my whole professional career, you didn't really have to think about what clothes you're putting on, just maybe how many layers you put on. And it's a bit institutionalized that I get into a new environment and I hate the day that I actually have to choose what to wear, because any other days I just grab one of my sort of Jeff Banks suits out of the closet and go with that.
Is it paralyzing? Well, you're late for work there.
It takes me a bit longer to get ready. That's about all, yeah.
All right, well, that's about it for this episode of The Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport, the home of cycling. Thanks to our sponsor, Lacquer. We'll be back next Monday with a look back at Paris-Roubaix. It's here, Brad.
It is.
It's nearly
best
here.
Race of the year, isn't it?
It can be, and we hope it will be. Until then, you can stay up to date with Brad on social media at...
Sir Wigo.
Got it off the cuff now. Easy.
Bang.
And Simon will be giving sound financial advice, presumably at...
No, I won't be giving any sound financial advice for a little while yet, but social media handles at Simon Gerrans.
If you want to follow Simon, he's there. Plus, you can follow Eurosport on Twitter and Instagram at Eurosport_UK, or you can find us on Facebook. And if you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe, share, rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice. But for now, a big thank you to Simon Gerrans for joining us. Thank you, Simon.
Thank you, guys.
And Brad, it's good night from him.
It is good night from me.
And it's good night from me, Graham Wilgos. We will see you next Monday.
The Bradley Wiggins Show is a Muddy Knees Media production for Eurosport.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.